The reason that you're interested in this tape series is because, for some reason or other, you're concerned about counseling. And I suppose the best way for us to begin our discussion of counseling is to ask the question, what is counseling all about anyway? The answer to that can be given in one word. Counseling is concerned about change. Every person who comes to counseling wants to see something or someone changed. He's interested, vitally interested in change. The counselor, on the other hand, has as his goal to bring about that change, to effect a change in the counselee, in his situation, or in others around him who are in some way related to him in his problem. And of course, that raises the question that immediately comes to mind: when people want change, it's because they see a need for change. There's some irritation, some problem, something underneath that acts like grit in the machinery that makes the red light on the dashboard go on. There's something that says to people, there's got to be a change. I suppose if any word characterizes it better than any other, it's that word, change. So this series of tapes is concerned about change. In fact, we might call it a seminar on change. Now, when you raise the question of change and are primarily concerned about change within individuals themselves, a number of questions come to mind. The first question, I suppose, to those who have had any sense of history at all, and who have lived for any period of time, long enough at least to become somewhat cynical about their fellow human beings and about themselves, the first question that arises is there really any hope for significant change? I know, of course, we can change from this to that, but are we really changing in any way that is going to make a difference to the individual, to others around him, and to society in general? Are we going to see a change in that person or in that situation that is going to be truly an advance? So some people are quite skeptical at the beginning. Because of man's nature, they see him as a being who really is unable to change vitally. Then there are others who ask questions about, from what to what shall we change? There's the problem, for example, that needs to be solved. What is the problem? At heart, at base, beneath all of the superficial factors that need to be altered, what is the real issue down underneath? When a man comes for counseling, what is it? And we get down to the bare essentials. What is it that really needs to be changed? What is his problem that needs to be solved? Or are there many problems? And toward what goal shall a counselor and counselee together press? That is, what sorts of objectives should they set before them in this process of change? It's fine to talk about change in the abstract, but where are we going? What kind of a man, woman, child, individual that we're working with should we seek to mold in this process of counseling change? You might get two psychiatrists or psychologists together in the same room who say, all right, we've got the process. We've got the meat grinder. We can grind any kind of sausage we want, but they might not agree on the kind of sausage. And finally, according to what standard shall this change take place? There are numerous ideas abroad today as to what a man should be like, what his problem is, how it can be altered. But they all presuppose a standard of values, a standard that sets some authority over the person and persons involved in this whole question of change. And then, thirdly, the issue is what means will be used. in these post-Watergate mid-Watergate days, or whatever way you want to talk about it, we're all very much concerned about means. That has come very strongly to the fore in all of our thinking. And perhaps rightly so, that we should be reminded that not any set of means can be used to effect any desired end. And last, as a fourth question that arises, suppose we do find out the problem. Suppose we do discover the solution. Suppose we do set the goals and set up some sort of program and have a standard by which to move and even from which to develop and adapt our means and test them by. How can we get the power to effect that change? That is, how can we find the authority for it? And how can we find the ability or capability to actually achieve the change in view? Now, these are the kinds of questions that arise, I believe, whenever a person thinks seriously about change in counseling. They don't always arise in the abstract form in which I've given them. They more urgently, as they come from counselees, press upon us in terms of the particular situations and cases. And we'll get to a great deal of that before we're through on later tapes. But right now, we're sort of surveying the situation, and we're sort of getting ourselves in shape to look at some of these problems as we go along from tape to tape. We'll not take them up exactly in the order or even exactly in terms of the headings that I have given. But we will get to all these matters before we're through. And I hope with a practical emphasis that will help you, as you go with us through this series of tapes, to use the means and to reach the goals according to the presuppositions that I hope you also will adopt. Now, today we're going to talk at the beginning of this series about this question of hope. The question of hope in counseling. After all, you know, that's where it all begins. The counselor enters into the counseling process, whether he is a layman, whether he is a minister, whether he's some other sort of professional. He enters into the counseling process with a great deal of hope, or he might as well not enter into that process at all. The counselee may come with more or less hope, but it is extremely vital that the counselor have hope. And as we begin our discussion of this system of counseling that I'm intending to present to you in this series of tapes, I want you to know that all that we will do and all that we will say in this series will be based upon the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. Because, as a fundamental presupposition, we believe that all hope resides in God, and that God has shared hope with us in this book, that he is the source of all hope, we read in Romans 15:13. But that hope does not come in some mysterious experiential way out of the blue. Indeed, in that same chapter, in Romans 15:4, we're told that that hope comes through the scriptures, which give us not only the ways and means for effecting the changes that man needs, and become the standard for all that we are intending to see change in an individual, but also it's these scriptures, because of their promises that they contain, that become the very foundation for any real hope in a counseling situation. There is, of course, a kind of false hope abroad today. People hope in hope. They hope in faith. They have an abstract kind of hope that floats somewhere in the blue. But we're going to bypass all of that kind of thing. And we're going to get down to the very concrete, specific promises that God has given in the scriptures in order to have a valid basis for hope. Now, I've said that hope is essential to any significant counseling and to real change. And first of all, I would like to explain very briefly that it is important for the counselor to have this kind of hope.
More that we'll say on tapes that follow will perhaps help the counselor's hope. But right now, the need for it. In 1 Thessalonians, the first chapter, in verse 3, Paul speaks of three words that we meet elsewhere and know from another passage more vividly. He speaks of faith, hope, and love. We all know 1 Corinthians 13 and that great hymn of love contains these three tremendous elements. And in that order, faith, hope, and love. But very few people seem to realize that Paul uses these words elsewhere. And in one of those other places in which he uses these three words, we have the same three but in a different order, and that is in this first chapter of his letter to the church at Thessalonica, in which he speaks of faith, love, and hope, reversing the order between love and hope. In Corinthians, where Paul, writing to that church at Corinth, recognizes that the prime need is for love, he builds from faith through hope to love. But in Thessalonica, where the prime need was for hope, where those dead Christians had become a source of real concern to the Thessalonians, who wrongly had inferred either from Paul's teaching or some false teaching that came their way that no Christians would die before Christ returned again, had begun to lose hope. And Paul writes in order to give them new living hope. That's why he says in the fourth chapter that he writes those words about the resurrection of all believers at the return of Jesus Christ, that they might not grieve as others who have no hope. So hope was the vital thing that the Thessalonians needed. And Paul, in discussing the question here, builds from faith through love to hope, saying this, your work of faith, your labor of love, and your steadfastness of hope. Now, he infers then that faith produces works. Works come from faith. But love goes beyond that. Love produces labor. A person will go beyond the task that's put before him and do the extra thing out of love. He'll sweat and perspire over the work if need be. He'll give of his heart and his life in love. But what does hope produce? That's the concern we have on this tape. Steadfastness, Paul said. Perseverance, that hang-in-there-ness, if you want to put it in modern terms. That which is necessary to go on in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of all the obstacles. Now, I don't know how many of you who are listening to this tape are fishermen. But if you're not, you'll have to bear with me throughout this series of tapes because I love to fish and don't get much opportunity to do so. And so I use a lot of fishing illustrations. And we're going to start right now. If you want to distinguish a genuine fisherman from a would-be fisherman, the way to do it is very simple. It's to check him out on the times when he fails to get anything and bring anything home. Now, the would-be fisherman goes out and he throws away a bunch of lures and gets sunbaked and comes home tired and blistered and says, I've had it, forget it, I'm selling my rod at the yard sale. But the real fisherman goes out to the lake and he gets scorched and he throws away a half a box of lures and he comes home skunked, which is a fisherman's term for getting nothing. And he's as happy as he can be. And a friend of his who doesn't quite understand what fishermen are all about says, how did you do? He says, I had a great time. It was just tremendous fishing out there today. He says, but look at your physical condition, and you've thrown away all that money, that box, half a box of lures, and you got nothing. Oh, he says, I know, but it was great. He says, well, I guess you're not going back to that pond again. He says, oh, yeah, going back tomorrow. He says, you're going back to that same place again tomorrow? Sure. Well, where are you going back there? Well, he says, because the fishing's great. Well, his friend scratches his head a little bit and checks him out when he comes home from the pond tomorrow. And tomorrow, man comes back having thrown away the last half of his box of lures, having blisters, epi-blisters on his blisters, and coming home double skunked. And his friend says to him, "Aha, now I know you've quit either fishing or at least that pond." He says, "Oh, no." He says, "The fishing was just great." He says, "Well, why do you keep going back there under those conditions?" He says, "Because it's wonderful. It's tremendous. Fishing at that pond is first class." He says, "Well, how do you know?" He says, "Well, it's just loaded with great fish. Lots of big lunkers, plenty of other fish." His friend says, "Now, look, I've had about enough of this. How do you know that?" He says, "I know it because I'm not taking any of them out." Well, you know, that's the way a real fisherman operates. Now, his hope may be well-founded or not, according to the circumstances. More often than not, I suppose it isn't. But the hope that we're talking about here is a well-founded hope. It rests upon the promises of God himself. And the interesting thing is that hope, real hope, always produces that spirit of going back again, going at it a second time, hanging in there, staying with it, persevering. That steadfastness of which Paul speaks here, the steadfastness that issues from hope. Now, unless a counselor, whether he be a professional, a minister, or whether he be a layman, a counselor needs that kind of perseverance. He's not going to win them all. He's going to run into discouragement and despair from time to time. He's going to have people right on the brink of change and only to find them turn around and walk briskly away. He's going to find that, like Jesus Christ, who spoke to the rich young ruler, not everyone will take good advice. He's going to find that, as when Christ spoke to 12 lepers or 10 lepers and healed them all, only one returned to give thanks and to hear the greater message of healing. And so there will be discouragement. There will be heartaches. There will be all sorts of pressures to quit or give up. There will be those times when you think, what's the use anyway? But when you really have a good source of hope, when you know that God has promised to use his word, and when you rely upon that promise, and when you continue on, sometimes the process of counseling itself becomes very difficult before it becomes better. Things get worse before they improve. There are the dark periods before they break into the light. And so we have those difficulties and we have those discouragements, and we don't give up, we hang in there, and we continue, and then, if we have that hope, we see the results. So the first thing that's essential is for the counselor to have this kind of hope. But what is hope? That's another question. This matter of the fisherman raises that issue, doesn't it? What is real hope? The kind of hope we're talking about, not the kind of hope in that illustration of the fisherman. The kind of hope that we're speaking about from the scriptures is a hope that we might actually characterize as confident expectation. When in Titus, for instance, we read about the blessed hope in the King James Version, even the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, that day of his unveiling as the God who came as man, that hope is not an uncertainty for the Christian. That hope is an absolute certainty for him. That hope is his confident expectation. We use the word hope so frequently today and mean thereby something far less. We mean a hope-so kind of thing. We mean, well, I hope I'm going to catch some fish today. I hope that this lure will work. I hope that this bait will do the job. But we don't really have that kind of confident expectation that grows out of a certain kind of promise that is ironclad. Well, in the scriptures, we have an entirely different situation. Hope in the scriptures never means hope so. It always means confident expectation. Indeed, in that passage in Titus 3, we might actually translate the words, the blessed hope,
something like this: the happy expectation, or the joyous anticipation. It is something we're anticipating because God has said it's going to happen. It is something we're expecting because God has promised it. It is a certainty toward which we look and upon which we stand and from which we move. So that's what we mean in this series of lectures on counseling by the word hope. Now, the expectation then is that whatever God has promised with regard to change and the means that will affect it will come to pass. God's promises about change in this book can be relied upon. God's promises are true, and the counselor may take a firm, solid stand upon them and operate from those promises. I want to say to you at the very outset that if you do, you communicate one kind of mood and atmosphere in the counseling situation. If you don't, you communicate quite a different one. If you really have a solid basis from which to counsel, if you have your feet on firm rock underneath, you communicate an air of hope to your counselee. You communicate an air of expectancy, an air of anticipation. If, on the other hand, you have a rather slippery or shaky or changeable kind of footing from which you move or from which you temporarily counsel and then move on to another, as many people do, you indeed communicate something too. You communicate to a person who has already been moving and not able to find any solid ground that you don't really have answers of the sort that he needs, that you don't really have the kind of confident expectation that he's been looking for. And let me warn you that if you indeed intend to be a counselor, that you need to have firm ground. Oh, not everything needs to be quite as firm as everything else. I understand that you may have to move along as you work with a person, learning a great deal of data about his situation and working tentatively from a certain kind of interpretation of those data until you get other data and so on, until you can firm it all up. But I'm talking about the fundamental presuppositions from which you move. You must have a platform on which to stand. And the scriptures have been given, as I hope we shall see, as that very kind of platform. Now, as we think about this matter of hope, the counselee also is a person who needs hope. Not only the counselor, in order to continue his work and in order to communicate to the counselee that there is hope, that there is a place where we can find this kind of solid expectation, and that there is some possibility of change, even of this problem which he comes presenting, but also the counselee himself needs to see that. He needs to have the counselor in a very concrete and specific way deal with his problem in terms of a hope that meets that particular need which is being presented to him by the counselee. So let's ask ourselves a few questions then about what kinds of problems counselees may come with. We'll deal with some of these in much more depth in later tapes. And with what kinds of expectations or hopes they may come. We'll also unpack that a bit in a later tape. But now, just in sort of a survey manner, as we look at many things in an overview in this first tape. Some will come with hope, already anticipating everything. They will be in the minority. Most people who come to another person are people who have given up on themselves, have given up on the possibility even of finding help. Most people who come to another person, because it's difficult to do that, have struggled with many other things first, and their hopes have been up and down and up and down and smashed to smithereens innumerable times around their feet before you meet them. So very frequently you'll have people who will come with little hope, with very little expectation or anticipation of much happening. Some will come as a last resort. Some will come dragged into your presence for counseling. Young people often are dragged to counselors by their parents or husbands by their wife. You can see the marks on the ear where the thumb and first finger have been pressing. And others will come hoping against hope. They come out of a lot of disappointment. They come out of all sorts of broken promises. Every sort of hope that has grown and enlarged within their breasts in the past has been dashed in the past. Now, because they've been hurt again and again, because they have continually suffered from having their hope fail, they come this time not really wanting to hope on the one hand, but on the other hand, hoping that there is hope. They come stiff-arming hope. They come with one hand reaching out for it and with the other hand drawing back that very hand that reaches for it. So they are hoping against hope, not really wanting the hope, daring you to this time be able to raise their hopes again, and hoping that you will be able to. Many people come like that. It hurts to have your hopes fail again and again. Now, what sorts of people need hope? Well, those whose hopes have been dashed previously need hope. The way to do this, the way to give them hope, is this time to show them that you're not going to move off of the same base as they have in the past. You are offering a new kind of hope, a hope that has the solid foundation of the Word of God. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says this. It says, there is no test or trial or temptation, all those translations are possible, which has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. That is, there really are no unique problems down at bottom. Oh, I know everybody's problem comes packaged differently. Everybody's problem comes with different sizes and shapes and circumstances and accidentals about it. But underneath, down at rock bottom, all the problems that people face today are problems that people have faced in every era. So there is really no unique problem. A lot of people try to get off the hook from assuming responsibility for their lives by saying, oh, well, now you see, my case is different. But on the other hand, that passage, while it establishes man's responsibility, also gives tremendous hope. Because it says, look, others have successfully gone through this situation before you. Others have faced this problem. You know, out in Colorado Springs, out in the Garden of the Gods, outside of the city, you wend your way along in a VW and driving through all these marvelous rock formations, a little quickly past that one huge rock balanced on a pinpoint, and along looking at these lovely formations and colors and shapes, when suddenly you see your road in front of you disappear into a sheer cliff of rock in what appears to be only a narrow slit in that rock. And you say, I'll never get this VW through that slit. I'm glad I've got this car. I can at least turn it around here on this narrow road. And just as you're looking for the right place to back up and turn around, suddenly your eye catches a small sign. And the sign says, the Narrows. Yes, you can. A million others have. Now, maybe it's 6 million by now, but I was out there a long time ago. And you know, you go through, and a minute and a half later, 1,000,001 have made that pass. Now, the reason why you endangered your offenders was because you said, all right, if 1,000,000 other people can do it, so can I. Now, the reason why you endangered your offenders was because you said, all right, if 1,000,000 other people can do it, so can I. And that's what God's saying in this passage. There is no test that has overtaken you but such as is common to men. Others have gone through it first. Indeed, the Bible tells us that Jesus went through it. He was in all points tested or tempted as we are, the scriptures say. And so we have not only the example of others who have followed him, but we have the example of our leader himself who showed us precisely, without fail and without sin, how to meet every test and every temptation of life that you and I have to meet. But that verse goes on to say, not only does it say that there is no test that has overtaken you but such as is common to man, it goes on to make the point that God is faithful who will not allow you to be tested beyond that which you are able to bear. Now, while no situation at bottom is unique, the interesting thing is that this second sentence quite beautifully balances that first. He says, there is no test that's overtaking you but such as is common to man, but God is faithful who will not allow you, individually or as a group, to be tested beyond that which you are able to bear up under. You see, no problem is unique, but every problem comes uniquely fitted to the individual who believes in Jesus Christ as his Savior. God has promised that every situation that the Christian faces, he may face successfully if he does so, according to the Word of God, in following Jesus Christ through the hole in that rock. But he has also promised that never does the test come at a time or in a shape or in a form or with those kinds of superficial accidentals that does not fit the individual to whom it comes. We can never therefore plead, this is too much for me, or I can't do that, or, you know, I just don't think I have what it takes at this time. No, you may not have it as you sit and contemplate it, but God knows that you will have it as you step out to meet it. If you are a true believer in Jesus Christ, that promise holds, you see. And that's what we need to communicate to those who are in trouble. Of course, if they're not true believers in Jesus Christ, they need to be told that this promise is the kind of promise that comes to believers. And then some evangelism needs to be engaged in. But notice, he prefaces that second sentence in this great verse with the words, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tested beyond that which you are able to bear. You see, there were a lot of people who might contest that statement. They might say, oh no, I can't handle this. Oh no, this is too much for me. But God has gone on the line with this promise. He has said his very faithfulness itself is at stake in what he is saying. If any Christian is ever at any time faced with a trial that is too much for him to carry at that point in his life, if he carries it God's way. Now, of course, if he tries to handle it his own way, we're not talking about that. But if he tries to handle that problem God's way and it is too much for him to bear, then God's faithfulness itself is challenged. And finally, in that verse, he says, not only God is faithful who will not allow you to be tested beyond that which you are able to bear up under, but he says this. He says, with the test, he will give a way of escape also in order that you may be able to bear it. Now that is a tremendous third factor. Not only does he promise that the test is suited uniquely to us, that others through his power and direction have been able to handle it before us. But he promises it will not always continue. Indeed, it's a very interesting expression that he uses. When he says, he will with, that is, together with the test, give a way of escape also in order that you may be able to bear it. Now you see, you know that these tapes are going to come to an end. And even if you're being subjected to listening to them by somebody else, you know that there must come a time when they end, this one and all of those that follow. And so you probably can bear up under the situation because you see daylight ahead. You see an end to the tunnel, an end to the work that needs to be done. And that's the way we all get through courses in school. That's the way that teachers get through them, too. And so God knows this dynamic, that if we can see the end, if we can see something out beyond that we're reaching for, we can endure something while we're in it, while we're going through it. And he promises that is the way that it is. You know, if you go camping, as my family does, you know that you're in bad shape if you forget the can opener and all you have are cans of soup and beans. But if you were thoughtful enough to take along a can of sardines, you're all right. Because if you have taken soup and beans and you have no can opener, you have to sort of bash them on rocks and use screwdrivers and pocket knives and all sorts of dangerous weapons trying to open these cans in a jagged manner. But if you've taken sardines, the key comes hooked on the side of the can. And that's what God is saying. Together with the problem, together with the can, the box, in which you feel all boxed up, sardine-like, in which you feel that maybe you've been canned and refrigerated, for that matter, you've got a key to get out. God promises that. He never cans us and throws away the key. Indeed, he hands it to us in the very test itself. And the counselor's job is to convince counselees of the truth of this matter. Now, one of the things we've developed is a little pamphlet called Christ and Your Problems as a means toward establishing that grows out of this particular verse. It establishes, hopefully, two things for counselees, responsibility and hope. One of the things you might find useful, therefore, in bringing hope is the presentation of a pamphlet, this one or some other like it, that establishes hope from the Word of God as a solid basis for those whose hopes have been dashed previously. Now, there are many other kinds of people who need hope. We'll deal with some of those as we go along on later tapes. But I would simply like to say something at this time about the crucial nature of the Scriptures as the basis for establishing that hope. In 2 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, and verse 15 through 17, Paul speaks about the Scriptures, and he says that the Scriptures are inspired by God. Now, that does not mean, as the word inspired would seem to indicate, to breathe in that motion. But rather, the Greek word means God breathed, and it speaks of God breathing out that particular motion of the air. And so what it's talking about here is not the inspiration of the writers, but it's speaking about the inspiration of the books, the material. And what he is saying here is this, that here we have books that have been breathed out by God himself, just as much as if he were standing in your presence in a physical body, speaking them by means of breath, physical air vibrated by your larynx, and vocal folds. These are just as much his words. If he were saying them audibly and you were hearing them in that form, then he would say nothing more, nothing less, nothing different from what he has said in these books. That, of course, is the basis for our counseling hope. And in the next tape, we're going to go on to look at what the rest of that 16th verse has to say and the 17th verse has to say about the method that God in this book uses and about the fullness that lies underneath of the equipment that God has given. Just here, let me read the rest and let us conclude this tape by thinking for a little bit about this before going into it in the next session. All Scripture is inspired by God and useful, that's probably the better translation of the word profitable, useful for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, in order that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. That's what we're concerned about. A man who is competent to counsel. A man who is competent because he has an adequate book upon which to depend. A source and a foundation for all that he says and does. That makes him competent. his skill needs to be developed in accordance with it.
At the end of each tape, we're going to give you an assignment. Today's tape talked about hope for change. Why not begin by examining your own hopes? If these are inadequate, discover where the deficiencies lie. Write these out. You may fool yourself otherwise. Let me suggest also that you study carefully Romans 15:4 and 1 Corinthians 10:13. In the study of this latter passage, 1 Corinthians 10:13, you might want to read the pamphlet Christ and Your Problems. How would you give hope to a counselee who is suffering from intense fear? Finally, using a concordance, check out significant passages on hope and encouragement for use in counseling later on. Remember that hope comes from emphasizing responsibility. If you are the member of a group, why not discuss that principle in your group before proceeding further?